This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Pressing Matters, and after this, we continue the conversation with John Dinges on his experience in covering the military coup in Chile in the 1970s. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
They, in the 1970s, began to fall like dominoes, one by one, into military dictatorship. Brazil started it as early as 1964. Unfortunately, regrettably, my government, the United States, supported these military dictatorships in every case. So as democracies were being dismantled, the United States was applauding on the sidelines. And I'm trying not to be rhetorical about this. That's actually the result of my years of reporting, looking at now declassified documents, looking at the background correspondence, I mean, the conversations that the Americans were having with the representatives of the military government, including the presidents, presidents like President General Augusto Pinochet. So it was clear that this was a period of time in which democracy had been sacrificed to the interests of global politics. This is during the Cold War. So I was in the strange position of being a not very important young journalist in a country that had just fallen into military hands, and people thought, oh, this is going to be a couple years, they're going to call elections, don't worry about it. Then the bodies started appearing in the streets. I did an investigative project more recently in which I actually documented with a colleague, we documented, this is grim stuff, but all of the bodies that arrived at the morgue, and the bureaucracy of the morgue was maintained intact. In other words, the doctors were doing autopsies. They would tag the bodies. They would try to find out their identity. They would compare their fingerprints. And they would register when they arrived to the minute, right? And if 18 bodies arrived at the same time, they would all be registered as arriving at exactly the same time, which was incredibly important information. For example, one group of people was, I think it was like 25 bodies arrived at the same time on, let's say, September 19th. The military coup was September 11th. At the same time, people near a river that goes right down the middle of the city, similar to the river you have going down your city, it's a dirty river that doesn't have a lot of water in it, and it has a cement bottom instead of a regular natural bottom. So they had taken people out to a bridge over the river and had shot them, and they fell into the river. But most of them were in the riverbank, and the bodies were just there. And then the military sent another truck, and they went down into the bed of the river, loaded all the bodies up into a truck, and took them to the morgue. So on the one hand, a massacre. On the other hand, they were doing their job of, well, there's bodies in the river. Go get them and take them to the morgue. So we called it the bureaucracy of murder. And then they would register and try to find out who they were. It's incredibly, I guess Hannah Arendt, who wrote this famous book about the banality of evil, told the story for us and gave us this trope of what happens when ordinary people in ordinary societies, in ordinary jobs, are confronted with mass murder. They operate with fear, perhaps, but they kind of go about their business as if they weren't really seeing what really is going on. And the details of the day-to-day documentation of these kind of situations is banal. The documentation of what happened, actually proving what was happening, because the government, of course, was denying it. They said, oh, well, a couple people were killed while fleeing. A couple people were, you know, shooting guns and attacking the police, and they were killed. But other than that, they didn't admit any deaths. They called it the law of flight, ley de fuga. So the law of flight meant that you would take a prisoner and say, okay, sometimes they would say, just, okay, go. And as soon as you turned around to go, they would shoot you in the back. So documenting this was our journalistic task, trying to document this, trying to get at the truth, and trying to avoid mistakes.
Was there a difference in the role that the foreign journalist played as opposed to the local Chilean journalist?
Yeah, we had much more freedom and protection. In the early days, what I was describing was what happened right after the military coup, and that you could have a similar experience in Argentina the next year and in other countries. So it was a pattern that was repeated over and over again. So at the
time, we're talking 900 killings a year, something like that?
In Chile, about that, yes. Over the period of the worst killings, about the first year is about 1,500, and then over the next 2 years, another 1,500, approximately 3,000 people. In Argentina, the number of dead was 10,000. And by the way, if you've read articles about Argentina, they keep repeating the number 30,000 dead. And because I've been doing research on this, of course, I said, well, okay, there must be 30,000 names of people that are dead. And the families of 30,000 people have protested that they're missing their father or their sister or their brother. But it turns out that number is just an extrapolation invented by somebody who wanted to, I think erroneously or counterproductively, magnify the victimhood of those who had been killed. And actually it has the opposite effect, because anybody that does any real investigation, they know that it wasn't 30,000, it's 10,000. What I wonder, this is a journalistic quandary. Do you repeat in your stories a number that is put out even by human rights organizations or the organizations of victims that you know is wrong? Or rather, you know that that number cannot be based on any facts that you can point to. So my answer was no. And by the way, 10,000, an enormous number of people in a country of 25 million people, in any country. And so exaggerating it would seem only to be counterproductive. But I've been criticized because in my writings, I don't use the number 30,000. Anyway, this is the early days was documenting the number of dead. And then after a couple of years, the local journalists couldn't do anything of this. They couldn't talk about this at all. Unless the government actually announced that somebody had been killed, they wouldn't mention it at all. So after a couple of years in Chile, it was then possible for journalism to operate a little bit more. They had closed down all of the newspapers that were not on their side. So there were two newspapers left, two companies, right? And there were a couple newspapers owned by one of the companies, and then one newspaper owned by the other one. And by the way, I'm not making this stuff up, as they say. The major newspaper that survived, we later found out, was assigned $10 million from the American CIA. I mean, it's like it fulfills every stereotype that you have. And I'm not saying that because, you know, opposition people told me that. I'm saying that because the U.S. government had to admit that that's what they did, and they did a report on it. So it's very carefully documented, fitting all of this stuff. So eventually, 2 or 3 years in, meaning me, a couple other foreign correspondents, and some of the local journalists, people started doing real reporting again. And there was a church-affiliated radio station that started to do news programming. And the point I want to make is that they couldn't denounce the government, they couldn't do anything remotely opposition, but they could call attention to the fact that there is a presence of church people, that there is a human rights organization, that if you have a problem, there's someplace you can go. And most of all, that there is a version of facts that you can trust. And so journalistically, none of the people doing this tried to be denunciatory or tried to, you know, criticize the government or something like that. If you did that, you would be shut down. But what they did was try to be more factual, more accurate, to serve the people with information in every way they could. Even if at the beginning there was only a little bit of information you could get out, but you could do it. And that was the job of journalism, to fill the small space that was there, that was available to us. And that was, you know, that was important.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Today on the show, we have an excerpt of the keynote panel at the recent Kuala Lumpur Festival. BFM's Umapaga Nampi Kepakan spoke to veteran journalist John Dingus, one of the few American journalists to reside in Chile during the most violent period of the military government. Here he is describing how he, with a group of Chilean journalists, co-founded the magazine APSI or UPSI as a way to get around censorship in Chile. You're listening to Pressing Matters, and after this, we continue the conversation with John Dingus on his experience in covering the military coup in Chile in the 1970s. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
In 1975, we created a news organization with a bunch of journalists, and we got permission to do a bulletin, a newsletter, which we called International News, right? Actualidad Internacional. So the government gave us permission to do this. We couldn't talk about Chile at all. We could only talk about other countries. And so what did we do? We talked about human rights in Brazil. We talked about Jimmy Carter, the new presidential candidate who was making human rights an issue. We talked about the Palestinian struggle. We talked about every campaign for democracy that we could come up with as a story. So that was one of the tactics. I mean, I don't say that that was that changed. It's hard to say that that changed something, but we were putting some truth into the public sphere, and that was important, I think.
So, John, why didn't the government, just the Chilean government at the time, why didn't they just see you as troublemakers and kick you out? Because you weren't Chilean. You were an American journalist. They could have easily deported you.
Well, I guess partly because I was an American and the American government was their primary supporter. And so they of course, gave lip service to freedom. They remember that when you get your mind around right-wing dictators, right? Who do right-wing dictators overthrow? The nasty communists who are taking away your freedom. That wasn't really true in Chile, but the rhetoric of the military government was, we have restored your freedom, right? And so in those freedoms are, traditional freedoms like the press. And so they would not admit that they had destroyed freedom of the press, even though they had closed down and confiscated 23 radio stations and all the newspapers except two. So they had to curry the favor to a certain extent of the United States, maintain the United States as a friend, and the United States was always kind of giving lip service to, we know you have a problem, we know that you have terrorists that you have to get rid of, but you know, do that, and then restore freedom and regular order, right? And eliminate the state of siege. So the government was trying to make the argument that they were improving human rights, and we were able to kind of walk very carefully into that space as it opened up. And the other thing that was happening is that created space was that I was able to... By the way, I wasn't writing with my name at that time. I had a credential. Time magazine didn't use bylines. And the Washington Post, where I wrote my most important stories, I never used my name. Until the very end of 1976, and 5 weeks after I wrote the story for the first time, a couple stories with my name on them, they expelled me from the country. So, but that's one of the stories. They expelled me officially with a law. They said, under this law, Marxist propagandists, narco traffickers, and homosexuals are subject to expulsion. This was the law of the military government, right? And I joked with the detective who had brought me in to expel me. I says, well, do I get to choose? So I obviously was a Marxist propagandist. But within the space they gave me to get my affairs together and get on a plane, the United States government protested, really for the first time, because Jimmy Carter had become president. And they knew they no longer had the acquiescence of the United States government. And so the ambassador's protest was accepted, and they reversed the order, to my great surprise. I later found out from somebody in the government that it was the secret police that wanted to get rid of me, because I had been writing about the phenomenon of disappearance, where the government would arrest people secretly and then take them to secret prisons, torture them, and then kill them and throw their bodies, usually throw their bodies in the ocean, and never admit that they had ever been in custody. In fact, they would deny it. They say, oh, these are Marxists who escaped the country, or they're in exile, or they would say things like, oh, well, that person was having problems with his girlfriend, or his wife was unfaithful to him, and so he left the country. I mean, they would say terrible things about the people they had just killed. So that was the phenomenon of disappearance, and I had started to write about that. I had documented month by month how many people were disappearing. And that wasn't even the story I wrote a byline on. But it turned out that they had, and they knew what I was filing, even though my name wasn't on it.
So John, fast forward for a second to post-dictatorship. We are seeing the, I guess, burgeoning of democracy. What is this, the early to mid-80s? And I want to get into some process questions, because I think developing countries, third world countries, countries where journalism is burgeoning, like ours, may want to know some of these answers, which is, how did these countries go about setting up journalistic standards? What model did they follow? Was it, hey, John, you're American, tell us how they do things in America, we'll follow that?
Not so much. My government was associated with destroying their democracy, so they weren't going to come to me to tell them how to have a free press. Sure, it's Latin America, and the U.S. model is always very important. There's an association called the Inter-American Press Association, which is all of the owners and major editors of almost all of the major publications in the United States, Mexico, Central America, and all of Latin America. They all get together three or four times a year with these meetings, and they talk about, there's a great deal of commonality and cooperation. And the U.S. pretty much peddling the idea of the U.S. way of doing the free press. But during this period, to our great joy, the Latin Americans began to codify human rights legislation. And they set up an Inter-American Human Rights Court. There was an Inter-American Convention on Human Rights that all of the countries signed, the exception of Cuba. And so all of the new democracies got together and wrote down the rules of the game that would apply internationally. This was amazing. And in that code, there are sections about the free press. And over the period of the next 10 or 15 years, there were a number of international court cases in which they dealt with particular problems in the freedom of the press. And over the years, by the year 2000, this code of law, this code of international law, had enshrined most of the most important standards of freedom of the press. So to my great enthusiasm and joy, I no longer had to talk at all about the United States as a model, because the model of a free press was there in the Inter-American Convention, in the Inter-American documents themselves. And so it became, for the first time, self-referential rather than referential outside the continent. That was incredibly important, given the context that the United States, Europe was always the good guys. They had never supported the dictators to a great extent, but the United States was the big dog in the room. And for the press no longer to have to, for me, representing the American press, and I became a professor of journalism, and I began to do a lot of speaking in Latin America, similar to what I'm doing. You know, I'm here talking with the reporters at BFM, you know, talking about their journalistic standards and, you know, helping figure out problems of radio journalism. In Latin America, I could use the standards that the Latin Americans themselves had uh, had created. And that was very important.
And that was John Dinges, former Washington Post special correspondent in Chile and in Central America, and former managing editor of NPR News in the USA. That's all for Pressing Matters today. Thanks for listening in. I'm Sharad Kutan for The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.